everybody. I'm Ashton Demery.
And I'm Nicole Demery.
And welcome to our Atheist Bible Study,
where the hymen is the equivalent to the male nipple.
Okay, I see the hymen's relation to what we're going to talk about today, but what's...
Yeah, it's because it's unnecessary. Here. Okay, so males have nipples, but they don't need them because they're not, like, feeding the baby. Useless. Women have hymens because before their body decides, like, you know, if they're going to have a penis or a vagina, it, like, still makes that little, like, urethra?
Yeah.
Okay, the, you know, cable that you pee out of. And that's what the hymen is. It's, like, the cord that would go into a penis. And some women don't have them. We don't need it. So some people don't have them.
All right. Well, today we're going to start on Deuteronomy part 2, starting from chapter 14 and going all the way up to chapter 26. So we're really getting into the main part of what's known as the Deuteronomic Law Code, which really started at chapter 12, but we kind of kept going with our first episode and got a little bit started into it. The Deuteronomic Law Code, though, is really considered the central part of Deuteronomy that the rest of it's built around. It's sort of a rewriting of the law codes that we've seen previously. So it's pretty similar in a lot of ways. You'll see a lot of the same stuff come up as far as what the laws are and what the expectations are and some of the things that they address, like consequences for things and how you should handle certain situations. But there are some pretty distinct differences, and a lot of the language is different, and the emphases are different for the Deuteronomist. So a couple of things about the Deuteronomic Law Code. A lot of scholars believe that it might not have been crafted by the Deuteronomists. A lot of them believe that this was something they found or that they got from somewhere else and then edited and then created the rest of Deuteronomy around it. And something that sort of points to this is in 2 Kings, it references a book of the law discovered in the temple during the reign of Josiah. And so a lot of times scholars associate that discussion in the Bible as referring to the discovery of the Deuteronomic Law Code. Hmm. And there's also a theory of something called the Deuteronomistic history. This theory is based on the idea that the books of Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings all together are actually a single literary work crafted by the Deuteronomists as a new history, right? So the idea is that we took this Deuteronomic Law Code and we centered it in the book of Deuteronomy in this sort of longer history that ultimately culminates in the rule of King Josiah. So from the perspective of the Deuteronomist historian, Josiah is kind of a Messiah-type figure that comes along and fulfills the Deuteronomic Law Code and starts actually instituting what the law should be. So, as I was saying, some of the emphases that are made in the book of Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomic Law Code are centralization. So the worship of Yahweh really should occur at the temple in Jerusalem. And you'll see this emphasis many times that we don't want worship to Yahweh and sacrifices to Yahweh happening anywhere but the temple. It refers to this as the place that the Lord your God will choose as a dwelling for his name. Very different than the phrasing of Numbers and the priestly text, where it talks about Yahweh dwelling among the people. Mm-hmm. For the Deuteronomist, Yahweh does not dwell among the people. In fact, it's just his name sort of that dwells upon the temple. Additionally, something I noticed that I didn't see a whole lot of discussion of, but you'll notice that the word that kings are mentioned more in Deuteronomy than you really hear anywhere else. Mm. That's not something discussed a whole lot that I've seen in the Elohist or Yahwist text. And definitely mentioned almost never in the priestly text. They don't really talk about kings because they really want to emphasize the spiritual, whereas the Deuteronomist is a bit more secular. It's not concerned as much with the spiritual and more concerned with the worldly, and so it has a little more discussion of kings and the pragmatic type stuff about that. And again, because they were really involved in pushing the propaganda of King Josiah. Mm-hmm. So with that, we can move on and start discussing the stories and
Okay. Well, there isn't really stories. It's mostly just like a list of laws, which makes it kind of choppy to recap.
Right.
Okay. So we start out with pagan practices forbidden, which is basically just saying don't lacerate or shave your heads for the dead.
Yeah. We talked about this a few times. It's sort of some kind of funeral ritual practiced by pagans, and they hate pagans.
Mm-hmm. Then we have clean and unclean food sort of revisited. So again, they talk about all the like different animals that you are allowed to eat versus the ones you aren't allowed to eat. It also mentions that you should not eat anything that dies of itself. So like don't eat anything that you find dead. But you could sell that to a foreigner.
Yeah.
Turn a profit off of that to a foreigner.
They can eat whatever they want.
Yeah.
This one, the major contradiction that I saw here was regarding what kinds of bugs you're allowed to eat.
Mm-hmm.
This one, it forbids eating of all winged insects. Remember before, it explicitly tells you you can eat locusts and generally insects that are locust-like. It describes it more specifically in terms of like the legs of the
Yeah, I remember that.
Insect, but it allows for the eating of locusts. And locusts do, in fact, have wings.
Mm-hmm. Wait, this one
says
you can or you
cannot
can't.
Eat any winged insects.
Yeah, okay, that's what I thought.
All winged insects are forbidden.
Yeah. And then we have regulations concerning tithes. You should save your tithe and eat it before the Lord. Unless there is too much to carry, then you can just go ahead and sell that for cash.
Right. Again, because the point is that you have to do... You have to eat the tithe in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go to the temple to eat your tithe. And so if you're not going to be, if you're too far and you can't go because you're a poor farmer, then just don't do it. You know, exchange it for money and then you can buy something at the closer to the temple and do it instead of having to take your livestock to the temple.
Yeah. There's also some discussion about how you should take care of the Levites. Which, okay, I can't tell if it's pretty sweet to be a Levite at this time or if it kind of sucks. Because you get everybody's leftovers and, like, are the people really taking care of you? Like, it kind of sounds like everybody's supposed to take care of you. But are the people really doing that? Like, there's no way to really make your own as a Levite.
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's hard to say what people were following because there were different guidances by these different books. You know, what was actually going on. So something here that I think is interesting, too, is who the tithes belong to. So this changes a lot throughout the Pentateuch. If you go to Numbers, the Levites are given every tithe in Israel as a possession.
Mm-hmm.
Every tithe. And a tenth of that then goes to the Aaronid priests.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that that they talk about in Numbers is that it's in return for the service that they have to the tent of meeting. Here, it says that the reason that the Levites get the tithes, they only get it every third year, they get all the tithes. And they get it because they have no allotment. It's a completely different reason. And you'll notice that Deuteronomist doesn't mention the tent of meeting ever.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a part of it, partly because the idea is everything should be centralized in Jerusalem. And also, they just aren't as concerned with this kind of spiritual stuff. And the Deuteronomist basically says that the tithes belong to the people, which is kind of radical relative to the ideas presented in other traditions.
Mm-hmm. Next, we have laws concerning the sabbatical year. So every 7 years, you should forgive your debts, but you don't have to do this if foreigners are indebted to you, only if Israelites are indebted to you. But also, none of this matters anyways, because God is going to bring abundance to you, so you don't have to worry about owing other people, because you're probably not going to have to do that. They
so
just
why
kind
are we
of
talking about
exactly,
it?
Exactly. I don't know why they threw that in there. Then next, it goes on to talk about how you need to give to your needy neighbors. It also mentions if you are sold a Hebrew slave, then you should release them on the seventh year, and you should set them up with some kind of money so they have something to establish themselves with. If he does not want to leave, then just go ahead and pierce his ear and he'll be your slave for life. And then, so originally when they set this up, it says specifically your male slaves. And then later it says also do this for female slaves. So it just, it kind of gives this feeling like this was thrown in afterwards. Like it specifically says, free your male slaves on this and set them up with some money. And then later it says, but also do this with the women slaves.
Right. And so the, as far as the Hebrew slaves at all, other parts of the Pentateuch, specifically Exodus, does not allow for Hebrew slaves. It does not acknowledge that Hebrew slaves can exist. It says that they're, you can't. You can only have like Hebrew servants, which is not considered the same as slavery. And then previously we only described this process of awling the ear and making them slaves forever if they don't want to leave for male slaves.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't ever describe that for female slaves because the idea of what a female slave was largely different and really largely similar to being a wife.
Yeah.
For this time period.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to rush through this next part. So then we have the firstborn of livestock. You should sacrifice it to God and eat it. Then they review Passover, the Festival of Weeks, the Festival of Booths, and they talk about appointing judges and officers again.
Yeah, so in this part for the Passover, it no longer can be done in any of the towns. It must be done at the temple. And the Paschal sacrifice is defined as being from the flock and the herd, which, I don't know, it seems like a meaningless phrase, but it, flock generally is a word that's meant to describe, it's a word used for groups of either birds, or it can also be, in terms of like agriculture, it'd be used for like sheep and goats. Herd generally will refer to cattle. But if you go back to Exodus, it defines very specifically in Exodus 12 that the Paschal sacrifice should be without blemish, a year-old male from the sheep or from the goats. So very specific about the age, which here it doesn't matter what age, and it cannot be cattle that you use for the sacrifice. So again, this kind of comes down to Deuteronomist just doesn't care. Right? He's not that concerned with like the exactness of these sacrifices and the holiness, right? When you talk about like a young animal, it's kind of gives it something a more like spiritual and cult-like aspect to it, but the Deuteronomist doesn't really care about the cultic traditions that much. Also, it says, you shall cook it and eat it, is like how it should be prepared. But Exodus 12 says specifically, you should eat it roasted over the fire with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, and not to eat any of it raw or boiled. When you say in the Pentateuch that something should be cooked for a, you know, a sacrifice that you're going to consume, usually that does refer to it as being boiled. So all throughout Numbers, there's several times where they talk about sacrificing and then eating a portion of something, and it specifically says you boil it. That's how you prepare these sacrifices that you consume.
Mm-hmm.
So by just saying they cook it, that implies that it's boiled, which is a violation of Exodus 12. And there's also a lot of rules missing about like circumcision and stuff. They don't mention the requirement to be circumcised to eat the Paschal sacrifice. And there's no mention of circumcision anywhere in the Deuteronomist at all.
Okay. So then we have forbidden forms of worship. So you shall not plant any trees as a sacred pole near the altar or a stone pillar. And this line is there because apparently this was a like Canaanite practice that they would do for their gods. So this is how they would honor Asherah, which was the wife of El, one of their major gods.
Yeah. Also, I found that Asherah, some scholars kind of attribute Asherah as being sort of an influence for Eve.
Mm-hmm.
The way they describe Eve sometimes is they describe Eve sometimes as the mother of all living. And it's just very similar to the way that Asherah is talked about. She's like a fertility and motherhood goddess. I think it just sort of emphasizes the ubiquity of like these kind of beliefs and sharing of them among these other cultures.
Mm-hmm. And then there are rules to not sacrifice anything with a defect, which to me, I feel like this part kind of says something about like how God feels about people with disabilities or like anything born with a disability,
mm-hmm.
that it's a some kind of divine punishment, or like you're already born wrong and unmoral.
Right. I think there really is like this kind of hierarchy structure of, I guess, purity in general. Like yeah. this idea of purity in this part of the Bible. The more perfect something appears to be, like the better it physically appears, and the, you know, less disease or brokenness it has, the more close it is to Yahweh, and the more Yahweh wants to be involved with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, anyways, just a little bit ableism I noted.
Yeah.
And then it also says anyone worshiping anything other than God should be stoned to death.
Deuteronomy really doubles down on like on idolatry, I guess.
Next we have legal decisions by priests and judges. So if a judge can't decide what to do with a case, then you should take it to a priest, and the priest will decide what to do because he has a connection to God or whatever. So God will tell him what to do in this case.
And if you don't follow it, you're stoned to death.
Mm-hmm. A lot of stoning in this one.
Yeah.
Then we have limitations of royal authority. So you are allowed to give yourself a king, but he's not allowed to have a lot of wives, and he's not allowed to accumulate a lot of wealth either. Which I'm pretty sure they break both of those rules later on in the Bible.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. Then we have privileges of priests and Levites. So Levites don't own anything or pass anything down.
Yeah, this section, the biggest thing is like, you look at Leviticus, it talks about who the Lord's portion belongs to. It says, you shall eat it in a holy place because it is your due and your son's due from the offerings by fire to the Lord, referring to Aaron. And here it says that the Levitical priest made the sacrifices their Lord's portion. This is like, this would be pretty blasphemous for the priestly sources perspective. And then, right, there's another phrase talks about the Lord your God has chosen Levi out of all your tribes to stand and minister in the name of the Lord. Again, for the priestly text, it's Aaron, and Levites are not at all allowed to minister in the name of God at all. Deuteronomy 18 also talks about the Lord's portion being the shoulder, the two jowls, and the stomach. Leviticus 7, it's the right thigh. And sort of on this, I wanted to talk a little bit about how this is kind of practiced in modern day. So in kind of direct violation of like this eternal law that it's the Levites are going to minister forever, there are no Levitical priests today. That no longer exists and has not existed for a couple thousand years.
That's not what altar servers are.
Is
that was a joke.
I got you. So in 70 AD, the Romans sieged the city of Jerusalem and they destroyed the temple. So there hasn't been a temple since. And if there's no temple, there's nowhere to do these sacrifices, and there's no Levitical priesthood. And they never rebuilt it because they didn't live there for over 1,000 years, basically. This was kind of new information to me. I don't know if that's like for everybody, but I thought rabbis were priests. I thought that's what rabbis were. But apparently that's not at all true. Rabbis are essentially kind of filling this vacuum of lack of religious leadership when you don't have the priests. But priests are really involved with the cultic aspects of this that don't really exist very much anymore. And rabbis sort of filled the vacuum in the early modern era by creating this idea of an oral law that they see as a tradition that's extended since the time of the Torah. And then they eventually formalized the oral law into what's known as the Mishnah and the Talmud, which are extra books that are considered kind of scriptural for Jews, but aren't part of the normal Bible. They're separate from the Torah. And so they fulfill what we generally think of a priest as doing, but they don't even necessarily have to be Jews. And they can even be kind of secular and still be a rabbi. It's more about like understanding and reading and studying the scripture.
Hmm.
But yeah, I just thought it was interesting that there isn't any priesthood. Apparently, there are like some really, really Orthodox Jews who want to rebuild the temple and bring back the priesthood. But it gets kind of sketchy for like a lot of other Jews in Israel today and elsewhere, because it's like, okay, if we're going to rebuild the temple, are we going to start doing sacrifices again? Because that's like a little weird modern day to start sacrificing animals.
Yeah.
As to the question of whether or not like this prophecy is violated, Christians would say no. Jesus is always ministering from heaven.
Wait,
so he is fulfilling. Well, the like claim that the Levites will minister to the people forever, even though they aren't today.
Yeah.
So the Christians say that Jesus stands in as the minister of representing the Levites from heaven.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So then we have a fun passage on child sacrifice, divination, and magic prohibited. Basically saying that nobody is allowed to commune with the dead or practice magic or anything of that sort. And that's why all of us grew up with kids who weren't allowed to read Harry Potter or play with Ouija boards.
Yep.
Which I was allowed to read Harry Potter. I was not allowed to play with Ouija boards, though.
Oh, yeah. I never tried it, but if I tried to bring a Ouija board around, oh, man.
I mean, I was personally terrified of Ouija boards when I was a kid. So that wasn't, I wasn't going to do that anyways. When you were religious, did you believe in ghosts?
Not really.
Okay, so now
I think I liked the idea of believing in them, but yeah.
So you never believed anybody could commune with spirits or anything like that?
No.
Okay, me either. Because I was Catholic and we mostly just believe in demons and like demon possession and stuff. Yeah. So anytime you thought that you were seeing a ghost, it was probably a demon. Now, I still don't believe in ghosts, but if someone tells me a story where they saw a ghost or they played with like a Ouija board and they felt some kind of spiritual presence, I 100% believe you. That is what I'm using my cognitive dissonance for these days.
You've replaced Catholicism.
I don't believe in ghosts, but I 100% believe, like, when somebody's telling me a story about ghosts, I believe that that happened to you and that that is truth. Like, that is real.
Cool.
I know.
So this section really kind of doubles down on like on the anti-sorcery stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more specific than the other sections. I remember we had like a really long discussion about like how much the Bible hates or doesn't hate sorcery and whether or not modern witches fall under that.
Mm-hmm.
And if witch trials are a result of the Bible or if that was just people misinterpreting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's pretty cut and dry in Deuteronomy, though, that like anything that is not from the mouths of the Levite priests is worthy of like you being stoned.
Yeah. I just remembered, too, that as a kid, I did try practicing spells.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like Harry Potter spells or like did you try calling upon
Satan? I didn't read Harry Potter as a kid. I didn't read Harry Potter until I was older. But I did read a book called, it was like Magic with a Y. It was like YCK. And I also read, you know, this about me. I read a lot of like dragonology type mm-hmm. books and they all had spells in them. And I would try to do them, but they were like so tricky because they would have a lot of like mundane things in the spell list, like things that I could find around the house. And then they would have one thing that's like, and you're going to need a mermaid scale or like a unicorn horn or something like that.
Yeah.
And so basically making it impossible for
you. Yeah, on your allowance, never.
I could have never gotten a unicorn horn on $20 a month. But yeah, I would try to practice those like privately with like as many of the things that I could gather from the spell.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely believed in that more than I ever believed in a god. I just really wanted to see a dragon so bad as a kid.
Yeah.
And this section also condemns child sacrifice, which, as we've talked about before, that is an aspect of Christianity. God himself sacrifices his only son. So, fuck you, Christians.
Yep, and calls upon Abraham to do it.
Yeah.
And he's such a great guy for trying. And he almost does it,
yeah. Then we have a new prophet like Moses. So, this section is all about describing how there will be another prophet after Moses. And this is probably referring to the next prophet who comes directly after Moses.
It's definitely referring to Joshua. Yeah,
but 100%. If you ask a Christian, they're going to say this is about Jesus.
It's always about Jesus. Yeah.
Okay, so it says that it's, again, like Ashton mentioned last time, prophets are necessary because nobody wants to listen to God talk.
Nobody
wants to sit around and hear what he has to say. They just want it to be relayed through somebody else who can, you know, just boil it down to the essentials. So that's why we need prophets, because God is boring. And you'll know that this prophet is real because the things that they say will actually happen.
Yeah. It's all really consistent, too, with the centralization of the church. It talks about, like, anybody else but this prophet, right? if they claim to be a prophet, like, kill them, you know?
Yeah.
So it is very consistent with, like, right, there is one valid voice for the interpretation of the Torah and for the word of God, and you will listen to no other. And presumably this voice will come from Jerusalem, and they will be sort of at the center of the Levite priesthood there.
Mm-hmm. Then we have a really fun section called Laws Concerning the Cities of Refuge. Mm. So this whole next part, I am personally convinced that this is a murder confession. That the
a
person,
murder confession?
Yes. And let me lead my case to
okay,
you.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Okay. So, well, first let me just give you a recap. So this part talks about how when the Israelites have finally displaced all their enemies and they've settled into where they should settle into, they need to set up three cities where murderers can flee to. And then it gives a fun hypothetical, which this is the part that I think is the murder confession. It says, if someone, let's just say anybody, is with a friend, an enemy, an acquaintance, chopping wood in the forest, and let's say their axe slips while they're chopping wood, you know, classic over the head chopping trees tactics.
Mm-hmm.
If that slips out and it hits this man in the head and kills him, this person is obviously innocent because they did not mean to kill this person. So they are allowed to then flee to one of these cities. And it's important for there to be three cities and not just one, because let's say there's only one city and it's too far to get to. So while this innocent person, obviously, is running away from this accidental killing, and somebody related to the person that they killed or loves someone that they killed is trying to track this quote unquote murderer down and kills them, that would not be good. So there needs to be three cities set up, so that way there's always one conveniently
close
located,
enough, yeah,
close enough for them to get to in this game of dangerous tag.
Yeah. It's so fucking silly. It's like we create this whole super convoluted system.
Mm-hmm.
When, I mean, this is a book of the law. Why not just make a law that, like, you can't just vengeance kill people?
Right.
And why are we now factoring in the manslaughterers, like, speed and agility? Why is that a part of this? Like, why is...
That's what I'm saying. It's
how fast they can leave.
This is written by a murderer who was like, I can't run that far. I'm going to need at least three cities to be able to get to. And also, now we have these cities set up where it's like, so we're just assuming everybody in this city is like possibly a murderer.
Yeah.
The just entire city is dedicated
city
to manslaughterers.
Yeah, it's just like, there's a lot of these parts of the Bible, you make this law and it's like, there's a simpler law to this. I mean, better yet, why not write a chapter on axe safety?
Yeah, don't overhand chop. Only and stay 5 feet away.
Verify
from your partner
the
chopping.
Structural integrity of your axe prior to use.
Yeah.
Don't chop within
two feet
of
a
buddy.
I mean, come on.
Well, do chop with a buddy in case you hurt yourself.
Okay, and then it goes on to say, if your territory gets bigger, which it will, obviously, because God loves you so much, so your territory is going to grow, then you need to add three more cities so there's always a convenient location for these murderers to run through.
Mm-hmm.
God, this gets so... Okay, so if someone does kill the person who committed manslaughter, and then they try to flee to a murder city, then that person who is committing this, like, vengeance, this act of vengeance, they need to be dragged out of the city and killed. Which, again, reads like a murderer, just trying to set up all these ways, like...
To protect themselves.
Yeah, okay, so that's that section. And then we have property boundaries, which is basically, don't fuck with the borders. Don't touch the borders. Law concerning witnesses. One witness is not enough. You need multiple witnesses. Again, written by a murderer. And if a witness lies, they should be put to death.
Well, it doesn't say that you do to the false witness just as they meant to do to the other person. So it's whatever the consequence of the crime they accuse that person of, they would have that done to them. So if it is death, then yeah.
Okay.
Or if it's like having their hand cut off, now they get their hand
cut
off. Which is contradictory to Leviticus 6, because before it was just like guilt offerings that you do.
Okay, then we have Rules of warfare. So it starts out by saying, don't be afraid of bigger and stronger armies because God is with you, blah, blah, blah. Before you go into war, the priests, they need to come out and give everybody a pep talk about how God is great. He's going to protect you all. Then, after the priests are done, the officials should come out and then they should give the opposite of a pep talk. Basically, if you haven't fulfilled something that you have been meaning to do, you need to get your ass back home and do those things because you might die.
Yeah, so I guess you don't have to go to war if you don't want to. It's like,
if you have unfinished business. What, man?
I really needed to go get my car in to the...
Yeah. I need to go return those library books.
I gotta go
get that in. I got some unfinished business at home. I would never go to war. I would always have something that I like.
Oh, yeah.
I need to go do. But yeah, so the priests come in and tell you, like, don't worry, none of you are going to die. God is with you. And then the officials come in and are like, hey, on the off chance that you die, which probably going to happen, you need to go, you know, tie up your loose ends before that happens.
Yeah.
Also, if you're afraid, you should go back, which would always be, if I didn't have anything to do, I'm like, I am a little scared. Yeah. I need to go back.
Yeah.
And okay, it's before engaging in war with these enemies, you should ask for peace first. And if they agree, force them to serve you. So your offering of peace is like, if you agree to serve me for life, we won't do battle with you.
Right.
Which obviously no one is going to agree to that. If they refuse, kill all the men. And then again, you're allowed to enjoy the women and children, which are considered booty.
Yeah.
But certain towns, you should kill everybody because we don't want their traditions to continue on. We want their traditions to die with them.
Yeah, so specifically anywhere within like the promised land. So basically it's saying like the Canaanites and all of those people,
yeah.
You have to kill them, every last one of them. But if you venture off to sort of take possessions in other areas far enough outside of the... Yeah. Promised land, then you can plunder them.
And then there's also some rules pertaining to fruit bearing trees. So you're not allowed to like chop down trees that give you fruit.
Destroy everything, but take care of the trees.
Yeah.
I think the Lorax like slipped a line in to the Deuteronomist.
Then we have laws concerning murder by persons unknown. So if you find a dead body, mind your own damn business. It says, it basically is like, if you come across a dead body, immediately stop looking. Don't look for any clues or, you know, ask people if they saw anything. All you need to do is sacrifice a cow and wash your hands of the situation.
I'm probably focusing on the wrong things here, but like, it says to break a heifer's neck.
Yeah.
How the fuck do you do that?
With two men.
You're going to break the neck of a fucking cow?
That's really intense.
Like, a heifer is a cow that hasn't had a baby yet. So, presumably, like, a younger cow, but even a calf. Like, the amount of force it's going to take to break that thing's neck?
Yeah. So, something that has been happening to me recently as we have been reading the Bible is I have to kind of, like, prepare myself before going back into these. And specifically when I get to sections like this. So, this next section is called...
It has the word woman, or women, female.
Yeah. I have to, like, mentally tell myself that I am a human being first before I am what my gender is, and basically guard my heart because this shit is so dark. And going back into it, it just makes me realize how many excuses I would make for this kind of stuff. When I would read it, I would just be like, you know, the whole product of their time thing. And I don't know. Some people try to argue that you can't judge people based off of like today's values. And I think that's bullshit.
You can certainly judge an eternal God.
Yeah.
By these
right.
values. You know what I mean? Like, it's one thing.
Well, and I think you can judge men too. I think they knew what they were doing was wrong. I think the only reason why this becomes acceptable is if you're like brainwashed into thinking that women aren't people or women are less than you. And that's how you get to this point where you can just do anything to these people.
Yeah, and it's also, like, if you're going to say it's just the product of their time, like, that's a reason to just stop listening to it.
Yeah.
To stop taking it seriously.
Right. But, yeah, I guess I just want to point out that, like, Reading this isn't always easy for me. Like, we make a lot of jokes and stuff about this, but, like, I actually really don't like to, like, put myself back into this again. And it's what I'm trying to get at is, like, have you ever had to do this where you have to remind yourself, like, I am a human being deserving of basic rights? You ever have to say that to yourself?
I'm going to be honest, like, no.
Yeah,
exactly. Because, like, everything in the world is constantly validating me as a white man, straight.
Like, yeah. And this wouldn't be so hard for me to read if everybody looked at this and was like, oh, yeah, this is stupid. But people take the Bible seriously. And, mm-hmm. like, you, whether or not you read it and you're like, oh, okay, I'm not really sure about that, like, it's still a part of the culture.
Yeah.
And anyways, I'm just grateful that we don't do this, that we don't practice Christianity anymore. All right. So this next section, female captives. If you see a woman that you like while you are out committing genocide, you can shave her head, lock her in your house for a month. And a month should be enough time for her to finish grieving the death of her life, all of her loved ones, everything that she's ever known. And now you can go ahead and rape her. This is what the Bible says. And if this rape is not satisfying to you, you can just go ahead and throw her out. You aren't allowed to sell her, though, or make any money off of her because you've already damaged the goods.
Yeah, so now she can scrub your floors or whatever. She's your slave.
Yeah.
The basic, like, ideas of all this is, just like, the women aren't really, like, autonomous. If she no longer has you killed her father, she no longer has a father who, like, is deciding her life. She's just yours to take now.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to risk dishonoring her father. And then also, like, I feel like they're, I don't know, it goes a dark place in here with the extent of, like, shaving the head and just, like,
yeah,
trying to really, like, I guess bring her to kind of, like, put her in her place a little bit. Like, you're Canaanite trash and, like, you're starting over. Like,
yeah.
I need to, like, break you down as a human and then we're going to, like, start you over and you can be with the Israelites.
Yeah, it's like, it's very much like livestock. Like, that's what, like, the treatment is like, you know, the shaving of the head is kind of like the branding. And then,
yeah,
it's just really fucked up. And that was hard for me to read. Moving on from that, we have the right of the firstborn. So your firstborn inherits everything, even if it came from your least favorite wife. Bible sucks so much. It's just like, I would love to, like, I almost miss the days where I was analyzing, you know, the poorly written female characters that we do have in the book. Like, when we were talking about the wives, because now it's nothing. There are no women in these sections. The only time women are talked about is in reference to, like, being fucked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then we have rebellious children. So if your kids don't listen to you, you are allowed to take them to the elders where they will be stoned to death.
Yep. You can get a return as long as you have the receipt.
Mm-hmm.
I ask, did your parents, when you were a kid, ever kind of use the Bible against you? Like, do you feel like they brought to your attention stuff that the Bible says about listening to your parents, or, like, used it as, like, to make you listen or make you fearful in any way?
No.
They never use this one, which is surprising. I mean, this feels like a really great way to motivate your kids. Like,
they're not going to be like, I'll kill you.
Yeah. But, like, one of the things that got quoted a lot in my family that I haven't found yet in the Bible, but, like, apparently there's something that talks about basically your kids, like, that are going to repay whatever you do as a child, like, sevenfold or something like that. Like, it basically says that, like, however bad you were as a kid, your kids are going to be, like, seven times as bad. And so that would be, like, the threat.
Oh, what you do now, your kids are going to do?
Seven times worse, right?
Oh, you got them because you ain't going to have kids.
Yeah, well, that's what I was like. I don't plan on having kids, so that, you know, I've weaseled my way out. But, like, also it's, like, it's a really weird way to think of it because it's, like, well, then I'm not actually in control. I'm just, like, the seven times worse than you are. I can't control that.
Yeah. It's just, I'm punishing you. So let me do my job of punishing you.
I can't do anything about it. God's puppeting me into being seven times worse than you were. And I guess I got to deal with the fact that my kids are going to be seven times worse.
Worse than that. Yeah, that sucks because it just compounds every year then.
Yeah.
All right. Then we have a section called miscellaneous laws. And it starts out talking about how if you need to kill someone, hang them in a tree and then bury them the next day. There's this line in there that says anyone hung on a tree is under God's curse. And I just think it's interesting because I feel like there's a lot of language in Deuteronomy that kind of pits people against nature. You know, you're not allowed to plant a tree near the altar.
Mm-hmm.
Even when you go to war, like the only trees that you can show respect towards are ones that like give you something, the fruit bearing ones.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, going all the way back to Genesis, the tree of good and evil is kind of like the spurring of what causes the downfall to all of humanity. And it feels like there's always this connection of like women to trees too. So like women connect with nature and like that's bad.
Because Asherah, like the imagery associated with her is a tree. I guess, sort of this life-giving thing.
Yeah, that feels right to me. Like, I'm not saying, like, we need to go from a patriarchy to a matriarchy. But, like, as far as how things get passed down, like, women are the ones who give birth to, like, there is a direct line there where women are always, like, certain, this is my lineage.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels like the Bible tries really, really hard to...
to stop that?
Yeah, or I was going to say, like, to disrespect that, to undermine that.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it says, if you find your neighbor's wandering animal, then you should return it to them or any other lost items that you find of theirs. Also, help your neighbor's fallen donkey. Women. Oh, I love this part. Women shall not dress as men and men shall not dress as women.
Yeah.
I feel like I should have something to say about
that. Well, what men and women have worn has changed so much throughout history that, like, what does that even mean? Men used to wear skirts, so...
That's what I'm saying, yeah! I was like, these men are literally wearing tasseled dresses at this time.
I'm waiting for us to bring it back. I don't know. I feel like I need to try out a skirt, like...
You've put on my romper before, like a Spartan, and you look pretty cute in that. That is come... What do you mean? It has come back. That's like a thing now. Like, men are wearing maid costumes.
Well, so the romper thing has definitely become kind of a thing. At least in like high fashion, but like,
dude, you need to get on TikTok. You're so.
I've seen the skirts, but it hasn't been like I haven't seen it be like, you know, that widespread yet.
Okay, ever since Harry Styles showed up on the cover of Vogue in a dress, that has like, I mean, even let's be honest, before Harry Styles, men were wearing like women's clothing
for sure.
But like, and I mean, like mainstream, like rockers and things like that. Not just talking about. The amazing, wonderful world of drag. But yeah, that has been kind of a thing. I have been trying to like push you towards that, but I just need to get you a TikTok suit.
Okay.
To marinate in you a little more. Some of the shit that like just gets included in the Bible is so weird.
It's
so
very this random. Next part,
if you happen across a bird's nest, it says, first it says take everything, but then it says, but then let the mother go. I don't know if that's some kind of metaphor or if they're just talking literally.
That's just some good,
but
like...
But just, like, thank you for that, I guess.
Just some good fish and game rules.
Yeah, I guess.
You know?
Yeah.
Good conservation there. It's, like, not taking pregnant crabs or whatever.
Yeah. And it says, make a parapet for your house or risk a blood guilt. And a parapet is just, like a wall, kind of, for your roof. Like a little raised section.
Yeah, or, like, a balcony. Like,
yeah,
having a little, you know, wall around your balcony.
Apparently, you need that. Don't mix your seeds around when you're planting. Don't plow with a donkey and an ox yoked together, and no wool or linen clothes.
Yeah.
But my character
don't mix things.
Is a priest, and all I can wear is linen.
I think you're referencing like a video game thing. Or
I am. It's World of Warcraft, baby.
All right. God also likes tassels. I don't know if you clocked
that. Oh, yes.
That.
I have clocked that. I need to, now I'm like, do I need to stop wearing tassels? Am I honoring God?
Yeah.
Okay, then we have laws concerning sexual relations. So
let's talk about sex, baby.
So say a man marries a woman, but doesn't like her. So he makes up a lie that she was not a virgin. Her parents should bring proof that she is a virgin, which I'm guessing is they need to bring the bloody cloth or something. It says like they lay out a cloth. So I'm guessing this means they need to bring the bedding that she first lied in when she had sex that's now bloody or something like that.
Yes, that was my assumption too, and I looked it up. That's exactly what it is. the first night they get married, mm-hmm. somebody is supposed to collect that, like, immediately. Okay. They're supposed to collect it and hold on to it.
Yeah. Which, okay, ties back to what I was saying in the beginning. Some women are literally born without hymens because, again, we don't need them.
Yep.
And other things can happen, too, where they can be broken. And, again, I just want to reiterate, virginity is a social construct. It doesn't mean anything. We just gave it importance for no reason other than to control women's bodies. So if they can prove that she was, in fact, a virgin, then she will remain married to this man and he can never divorce her. And the man will be given a fine. So it just sucks because, like, obviously if I'm a woman and my husband doesn't like me for whatever reason, he's trying to tell lies about me. Now my justice is, like, you are married to him forever and he can never leave you.
Yeah.
So I was like, great. That's great for me. If there is no evidence, then she is stoned to death.
So it's like, well, one, it kind of, like,
there is no contradicts good way.
The false witness thing.
Yeah.
Right. Wait, this is the exception to the false witness, right?
Mm-hmm.
The husband is bearing false witness against his wife.
Oh, right. Yes.
And they say, okay, it'd be way too extreme to stone the husband.
Yeah.
For this.
It's because women aren't people in the Bible. It's so frustrating.
But yeah. So it's like, if you, because this is attempted murder.
Yes.
You're attempting to murder your wife.
Yes. Getting so mad. Next. If a man lies with another man's wife, then they both will die. If a man sleeps with an engaged woman, they will both die. Her, because she did not cry for help. And him, because he has disrespected another man, basically. Also, another good time to point out that when it comes to victim blaming, some people have this idea that if a woman is being raped, that she should put up a fight and kick and scream, and there should be marks on the man or marks on her that show that there was, like, some kind of resistance. And that's not always the case, because sometimes your reaction isn't, you're not in the wherewithal to take that kind of action. Sometimes you just freeze up, and that's your body's response trying to protect you because it feels, you know, threatened, and it feels like maybe there's a chance that you could die if you fight back. And so you just kind of lock up. And so, yeah, so it's not really on the woman if the woman didn't, like, scream or protest or anything, because sometimes it's just, that's just what your body decides to do in that situation, you know, kind of not in your control.
Mm-hmm.
However, if this same situation happens out in the country, then only the man will die, because there's a chance that the woman did try to cry for help, but nobody heard her because they were out in the middle of the country. Now, if a man lies with a woman who is not engaged, then he needs to pay her father of some, like 50 shekels or something like that. And he also needs to take her as a wife. Because otherwise she's dishonored. And a man cannot marry his stepmother or his mom.
Yeah. Is that the end of that section?
That is the end of the laws concerning sexual.
Okay. Abortion. So I want to draw attention to one thing first, which is that, like, in general, in the Bible, there are not very many crimes you can commit against a woman. And in fact, rape is not one of them. Rape is not a crime against a woman, according to the Torah, right? So all of these crimes are against the father or the husband.
Yeah.
So we talked about, like, being accused of not being a virgin. It's not a crime against her. It's not attempted murder against her. The crime is committed against her father in dishonoring his name, that he allowed his daughter to go out as a harlot prior to giving her in marriage. So he is paid the fine,
mm-hmm.
not her. When a woman is engaged and sleeps with another man, then they are both sentenced to death. Or if she's raped, mm-hmm. then he is sentenced to death. Only if she is engaged. If she is not engaged, it doesn't matter if she's raped.
Yeah.
Whether she's raped or not, it's 50 shekels to her father and he marries her.
Yeah.
Right? Because the crime is against her father, because if a woman no longer has her virginity as a daughter, she becomes useless to him. Right? He can't marry her off and she's kind of a burden on him forever.
Yeah.
Crime is against the father.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's another, like, fun little read where I get to remind myself, like, I am a person. I am more than just my vulva and my vagina.
Yeah.
and how intact my hymen is. Then we have those excluded from the assembly. So if your balls are crushed or your penis is cut off, then you are not allowed in church.
Yeah, I want to know who's checking this. Got a guy at the door doing a little peeky.
And also, like, was there an accident? And someone was like, kind of makes me uncomfortable that John doesn't have balls anymore. I kind of think he shouldn't be allowed near us, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine, man, it must have been a rough world back then. If there's enough people getting their balls crushed.
Or your penis cut off.
That this needed to be addressed.
Also, illegitimate children are not allowed. So no Jon Snows. No Ammonites or Moabites. But Edomites and Egyptians, maybe.
Maybe. We did like a complete 180 on the Moabites.
Again.
But yeah, between like the beginning of Deuteronomy and this part of Deuteronomy.
Yeah. Kind of makes you think, maybe all this is a lot.
Nah. Also, the like generations thing was confusing to me. Like, what does that actually mean?
Mm-hmm.
I looked up some things and I found some things on Torah.com that talked about it, but it still didn't really feel like it cleared it up for me. Like, I guess my first intuition is like, is this talking about intermarriage? Like,
wait, when you say generation, are you referring to the part where it's like up until this certain? Like if you're
the third or the tenth generation
of the for the illegitimate children,
it might have talked about it for that too. But yeah, it talked about that too. But it also talks about it for the Edomites and the Egyptians and the Moabites.
So if they intermarry,
that was my first intuition. Is like
yeah,
talking about like somebody if somebody marries an Egyptian or something like that, their children are not going to be legitimate until like the tenth generation or whatever because they're Egyptians.
Yeah.
The Torah.com thing talked about like it might also be just referring to at this time, I guess there was a sense that foreigners could kind of be adopted into civil life in a community. And so it's the 10th generation just of Egyptians from that time. So that much time has to pass before Egyptians can join or that much time before Moabites can start to take part in Israelite life.
Yeah. Oh, and I wanted to mention too that it says Edomites are okay because they are the descendants of Esau, and so that's like still their brothers is their reasoning for that. The reasoning for why Egyptians are okay is because they were aliens in the Egyptian land, which feels like a very watering down of what according to their history, where they were enslaved, calling them aliens in the land feels a little like not quite exactly what the situation was.
Right. And I think this, again, comes from, like, the Deuteronomist chronological perspective. Like I said before, that during this time period, there were uprisings that the Israelites took part in against their Assyrian and Babylonian overlords that the Egyptians took part in as well. So they were allies.
Mm.
So they talk about Balaam again here, and it's, like, another negative depiction of Balaam, where we're blaming Balaam again, even though the narrative itself doesn't really seem to blame Balaam. It's something we actually miss something from Numbers. If you go back to Numbers 31, which is the first time we blame Balaam, do you remember the Balaam story or the Moabite story in which they, like, the women come and Phinehas, like, you know, kills one of them or whatever, right? Because the Moabite women are sleeping with the Israelites.
You're talking about the one where he kills them while they're having sex?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so that's the Moabites.
Yes.
When you go to Numbers 31, it talks about the Israelites taking vengeance on the Midianites and taking the Midianite women captive for all the things that the Midianite women did. And Balaam had told the Midianite women to do this. So it changes who they're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because Moses is married to a Midianite.
Wait.
Well, so if you think about it that way, right, the priestly text is interested in raising up Aaron and sort of diminishing Moses. So by changing it to
was Zipporah a Midianite, his first wife?
Yes.
Okay.
So when you change this story to being about Midianites, it's another shot at, like, Moses, right? He married a Midianite instead of marrying an Israelite woman. He married a Midianite. Look what the Midianite women do.
Mm. So they were a different religion? Because that is kind of like...
Not what you saw in The Prince of Egypt?
Yeah. Okay, in the Prince of Egypt, like, I know her father, Jethro, or whoever her father is, we don't really know. He talks about God, but in the movie, their culture seems different.
Yeah, I wouldn't take
the I'm Prince not of Egypt taking to be. It that seriously. I'm just saying I got the sense that he wasn't marrying somebody who worshipped his God.
Yeah, and I mean, that I think is the depiction of the Bible too, right? Nobody but the Israelites is truly God's people.
Yeah.
Some of them acknowledge God, but also practice these pagan things. And in fact, so do the Israelites.
Yeah. So now moving on to sanitary, ritual, and humanitarian precepts. When you are camping out for war, you must remain clean. So...
I like if these ones.
In the middle of the night, you have a nocturnal emission, whether this means pissing the bed, coming.
It's coming.
Both? I don't know. It's coming?
It's okay. Coming.
You need to wash up and stay out of the camp for the whole day. Thoughts on coming in the middle of the night action? Anything you want to add?
I mean...
Any experience tales you want to tell?
I mean, it's another opportunity like, oh, sir, I really can't go out to war today. I came last night.
See, okay, so this is why I got confused. Why, like, I was like, I wasn't, I know that's a thing that men do. Sometimes they come in their sleep from wet dreams or whatever. But this next part, it talks about how there's like a designated spot that you need to like take care of these things outside of the camp. So I was just confused. Is it talking about shitting or is it talking about a designated jerking off spot for the men to go to?
I don't have the quotes in front of me, but I definitely read that pretty clearly as shitting.
Okay. Well, it just came hot off of talking about nocturnal emissions. Mm-hmm. So I just wasn't sure. I think it's for both then. I think both situations is just talking about both things that men do in the night.
Okay.
But yeah, so basically you need to do your business outside of the camp, bury it. There's another line in there that says, it talks about how people who have been enslaved shall not be given back. So I don't know if that's referring to like their enemies enslaved.
It's referring to their enemies as far as I can tell.
Yeah. There's that. And then there's another part where it talks about how daughters and sons of Israel shall not prostitute at the temple, which I looked into a little bit because that seems like a very specific thing to condemn. Apparently, in some other religions, there were sacred forms of prostitution in which, like, there were temple prostitutes, and it was, like, it was still prostitution, but it was in worship to their god, so it was, like, a holy form of prostitution.
Wild.
Some things that I found were, like, so for, like, Aphrodite, she had temple prostitutes, and then in Babylon, apparently, it was a tradition that women would need to prostitute like at least one time at the temple, and they needed to accept whoever came up and offered them money first. They needed to take that money, do the thing, and then they could move on with their lives. Then it talks about how you should not charge interest on loans to Israelites, but it's okay to do that to foreigners. You need to fulfill any vow that you make because God is always listening. You can also eat as many grapes as you like from people's vineyards, but don't put any in a container and take it home with you. And as a former cross country runner, I stand by this law. This is a good law to go by.
Yeah. I figured you'd like this one.
Yeah. Okay. Then we have some more laws concerning marriage and divorce. So if a man divorces a woman and then she marries another man and he divorces her or he dies, then she may not remarry her first husband.
Yeah, this was really weird.
And again, like the way this is worded, it's just like the women have no agency. It's just like all, anytime there's a lot of stuff mentioned where a man is marrying a woman or having sex with a woman, and there's all this talk of like, if the sex isn't that great, like if you didn't really like it and you want a divorce, then like this.
Right, and only a man can divorce a woman.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's weird because it's like, okay, so you can divorce a woman and you can remarry her. But as soon as, like, there's another man in between, then you can't. And, your first intuition is like, well, like, you know, she's had sex with another man. So, you can't, like, have sex with her now because it says she's defiled, right? The sex is what defiles her. But, like, well, that would be true for the man who married her second, right?
Yeah.
She would be, quote, already, defiled or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I looked into like some explanations of this. There's a lot of different ones, and they're kind of partially explanatory, but also have their like shortcomings and are kind of confusing. But one of the theories about this is that it prevented the husband from remarrying for financial gain. So there's like, if they come to a place where they're kind of like down on their luck, you know, maybe they can remarry her and get and gain regain kind of her dowry, because they give that up when they divorce her. And it's also the best one that makes sense to me is that it's just meant to like make you think twice about divorcing your wife, maybe. Like, hey, you know, if you divorce her, like, and she remarries, you can't remarry her, right? So just keep in mind it's kind of final. But it also like gives you that if you just divorced her, like some time to like, hey, you should probably think about remarrying her, because as soon as she gets remarried, she's gone, you know? So that's like the closest I could find. But what's really interesting is that in the Islamic version of this, it's actually the opposite. You can only remarry her if she marries somebody else in between.
Oh.
Once you've divorced her, you can't remarry her until she marries someone else. And apparently, although like some of the more like the Islamic sources I've read on this, like this is like completely like it's frowned upon and not like consistent with what the intent of it is. But some people apparently, in order to be able to remarry their wives, they would like hire someone. Like you could hire a beggar or something to marry your wife, have sex with her, and then you could get her back.
Interesting. Romantic. Really?
Very. It's kind of weird.
Yeah. We have some more miscellaneous laws. Part two. When a man newly marries, he gets to stay with her for a year. So he doesn't have to go to war or anything. He just gets to spend time with his new wife, which should read as like kind of romantic, but just like everything we've read so far leads me to believe that there was no romance at this time and that it was impossible to love a man.
Yeah, and that they had no army at this point. You'd only have to go if you want to, and like got anything going on at home, go back and take care of that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they did, because, you know, men are so much of their value is placed on protecting and.
Yeah. The thing I was thinking about with this one, too, is like if you're rich, you can get out going to war forever because you just take a bunch of wives, right? Because you're wealthy enough to do that. You just keep taking on wives.
Yeah.
Once a year.
Okay. Then it talks about how kidnappers are put to death. You need to wait outside while waiting for a loan. Make sure you pay your workers their wages. Parents and children are not responsible for the other's crimes. So, like, parents are responsible for their crimes. Children are responsible for their crimes. And they can't be punished for the others. And if you forget anything in the field, just leave it there for whoever is hungry.
The whole, a child can't be put to death for the actions of their parents is, like, really weird, considering all the times we talk about how God punishes to like the 10th generation or whatever. Like, we just basically said you can't punish a child for what their parents did, but that's what God's all about.
Yeah, that's kind of like his MO. Then we have levirate marriage. So if a man dies, his brother should marry his wife and have kids in his brother's name. And if he refuses to do this, then the elders need to take off their shoes and spit on him.
Yeah, and there's a phrase they say, right? There's like a catchphrase. His house is referred to as the house of him whose sandal was pulled off. That's like the biggest insult ever, apparently. Like, now you're the house of him whose sandal was pulled off. This one is another interesting contradiction. If you look back to Leviticus 20:21. If a man takes his brother's wife, it is impurity. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless. Right? So it was a form of impurity to have sex with your brother's wife because of that sort of closeness that you have to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like almost like a contact between you two. I think you kind of talked about that before.
Right.
And some would probably say, well, like, you know, that's talking about adultery. That's if your brother's still alive. And this is talking about if your brother's dead, then you have to take his wife. But that's not true. And here's why. Because in other parts of the Bible and in Leviticus 20, like a couple of lines before this, it defines what the punishment for adultery is. And it's a much more severe punishment, right? It's not being childless. It is death. Mm-hmm. Your punishment for adultery is death for the woman and the man. So it would be completely superfluous to even discuss the consequences for having sex with your brother's wife while he's still alive. So that is just referring to if your brother divorced her or if your brother was dead. So what's interesting about this too is it's like a huge turn, because in this case, you're obliged to marry your brother's wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not like just an option. You're obliged.
Right.
While it's completely like you're...
Right. You're a devil's disciple if you don't.
Yeah. And so it comes out of just like... It's the Deuteronomist is an older source than... It's an older source than the priestly source.
Okay.
And in some of the Yahwist and Elohist texts, there is reference to this tradition as well. Right. And so, again, it's more secular. It's like... At this time, it might have been sensible to take your brother's wife because she has nowhere to go, right? If she's outside of, you know, the house of her husband, if she's a widow, right, probably doesn't have anywhere to be. So it makes sense for you to take in the wife of your...
The wife of your brother.
The wife of your brother. Whereas the priestly text is much more concerned with ritual purity. So it's not as concerned with these, like, pragmatic concerns. It's really about, like, the cult and the purity aspects of it. And I think it's interesting, the priestly text says that you'll be childless if you do this, whereas that's the entire purpose of the Deuteronomist, is to
continue the line of
your brother.
Okay, then we have various commands. So if two men get into a fight and one of their wives tries to intervene to help their husband out and they grab the other man's balls, then that woman needs to get her hand chopped off.
Oh man, yeah.
And then it says, do not show mercy. How often was this happening? They needed to write this down.
I don't know.
Well, chop my hands off, because you ever get into a fight.
I hope you do.
Going straight for that man's balls.
That's a woman who's there to look out for you.
Yeah. Then there's just some parts that show how outdated the Bible is. Like, there's a part about how you should only keep fair weights in your house. Like, when you're... weighing money or something like that, like,
yeah, I mean, he's talking about like there was no universal like systems of weights and measurements and stuff like that. So like, you know, if you've got, you can't have like multiple different measurements, because it allows you to kind of cheat the system and use it for your advantage if you have multiple. But even if your measurement is different from somebody else's, as long as you're using the same one for everything, then, you know, in theory, like, it kind of balances out.
Sure.
It talks about blotting out the remembrance of Amalek. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we have the first fruits and tithes, which is just instructions for the first fruit offerings that we've seen kind of before.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like this, like, calls it concluding exhortation, which feels suspiciously like a conclusion. You read it, mm-hmm. it feels like this is like a very concluding paragraph.
Okay, but Deuteronomy does not end there.
No, it's just, you know, it's another indication of this 12 through 26 Deuteronomic law section, right, as its sort of isolated thing, and then we just kind of slap the other stuff onto the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's all we really have for this episode.
Yeah.
So we'll keep going in Deuteronomy next week and close it out. We'd love to hear any feedback on Twitter or on the Apple Podcast. If you'd like to give us a rating, we'd really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, if your parents ever threatened you with the Bible, tell us about that. We'd love to hear about that.
Oh, tweet us, yeah.
Okay, we'll see you next time.
Bye.